are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, June 5th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, founder of Labor Notes, author of several books on U.S. labor, currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Study of the Production of the Built Environment at the University of Westminster in London, Kim Moody. On New Terrain, How Capitalism is Reshaping the Battleground of the Class War. Also on the program, it's primary day. And Cali may tell us the outcome of November. Meanwhile, the U.S. government has run out of room to hold refugee children hostage. And how the homophobic baker may help kill the Muslim ban. Meanwhile, White House Operation Demonize Black Athletes may have just, in fact, fizzled. And fortunately, good news, Melania Trump lives. And Donald Trump talks economics to Gold Star families. Robert Mueller wants Paul Manafort's bail revoked for attempted witness tampering. We may act out in today's program when Paul Manafort pooped his pants, when he realized, like, oops, guess WhatsApp is not so secure.
That's what he said. That's what I said. That's obviously what our position is.
Ron gears up for potential no nuke deal world. Four states could expand Medicaid this year. And a Kuwaiti resolution could, in fact, be a glimpse into the Israeli-Palestine future. All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. The Paul Manafort thing is an amazing story. Last night it was reported that, and you know, look, I don't know what this has to do necessarily with Russian collusion. Maybe everything, maybe nothing. But Paul Manafort is sure is acting like a guy who's guilty of a lot of stuff. I don't know if it's Russian collusion or what, but
could be various things, any number of things that that happened in various regards.
FBI Special Agent Brock Doman, and you don't. Well,
I don't want that guy harassing me.
No.
Sounds like a screenplay character.
Honestly,
it sounds like
from
a
the Michael Scott movie.
Like, yeah, exactly. From a Michael.
Is that the name of Benjamin's character in Archer? Well, I guess it's Archer, right?
Oh, it's Archer, right? Yeah.
Brock Doman Archer. In a declaration filed with Mueller's motion, and this the motion was to have the U.S. District Court in D.C. revoke or revise an order releasing Manafort ahead of his trial. In other words, like, you let him out on bail, don't do it. The guy should be in jail because of the stuff he's up to now. And he's supposed to be confined in his home, and apparently he's staying there.
With cabin fever.
And so Manafort had attempted to call, text, and send encrypted messages in February to two people from the Habsburg Group, which is a firm he worked with to promote the interests of Ukraine. It's a
really
PR.
Like a grouping of Italian of European politicians. I don't even know if it's like a formal consultancy. I think it's like an informal, like, we will take a bribe.
Called the Habsburg Group?
Yes. Well, it has to do because of Austrian connections. Yes. Okay. Which still sounds ridiculous.
Good branding. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Great branding.
So they're not a communications firm.
So the FBI has documents and statements from the two people, as well as telephone records and documents recovered through a search of Manafort's iCloud account.
I have to say is...
Listen, here's a tip, okay? And it's almost...
For all gentlemen out there right. who may have used your WhatsApp account in a less than ethical manner, make sure it's not synced up with your iCloud. Even the most technically illiterate among us know that.
We're going to be doing a special episode of the Michael Brooks Show, which is going to be... bringing up WhatsApp episode, charges yeah. against Michael.
Imagine an episode where I give somebody tech advice.
through a search of Manafort's iCloud showing that Trump's former campaign manager attempted communication while he was out on bail. They were in an effort to influence their testimony and to otherwise conceal evidence. The investigation into this matter is ongoing.
Agree. I don't have time for this. I got to funnel $1 million to Romano Prodi. Agree.
Unbelievable.
Yes, it's synced up. Does that mean the money went through on the wire yet?
I mean, they give me 100 extra megabytes if I just say yes to this.
Wait a second. I don't want to say no to that. They said that I could be potentially eligible for an upgrade. Okay, agree. Did the money go through?
Automatically uploaded my spreadsheets. What are you going to do? I didn't realize.
I don't understand. Is there a side conversation we can have? I have some tenants in Brooklyn. I'd like to have them board out of their apartment so I can correct the insurance money.
Never understood.
I saw on WhatsApp.
Never understood why you use fake names in the ledgers. Never understood it. Now I get it. I thought if it was on my phone, nobody could see it.
So on WhatsApp, this is Paul Manafort. I'm on the encrypted service known as WhatsApp. And I'd like to engage in an act of bribery with the Habsburg group.
Should be an app for that. Should be an app. It's the Uber for bribery.
Yeah, Elon Musk it's like Uber, about
rockets. For bribery.
He's all about going to Mars. What about bribing European politicians?
Yeah, dude, all those, like, what's that thing where you get, Frog Task or Task Rabbit.
I like that. Frog rat? What did you call it?
It's called Frog March.
It's called Frog March, yeah. That works.
Task Rabbit, I had a couple of those guys over Task Rabbit. I gave them a couple of paper bags. Can't trust those guys.
He's like, what we're going to do is we're going to tape this money inside your vest. Yeah. And we're going to fly you to Kiev.
Can you put it
over WhatsApp so the special prosecutor does not know.
I want.
Oh, goddammit, I agreed to everything. Again. I did.
Task Rabbit, you filter out just someone wearing loose fitting clothes.
Should it go without saying that I don't want my WhatsApp synced to my iCloud? It's an encrypted service. It's like there's no respect for the customers anymore.
He's tweeting at Apple.
Hey, Apple. Hey, at Tim Cook. Steve Jobs would have never done this. He put the consumer experience first.
You know, the sad irony is that he's on home arrest and probably now has figured out all these tech things, right? He's got nothing else to do except I've really taken this time to really understand tech. But, you know, I guess a month or two too late.
I should have been on Signal. Okay, let's do a reset. How about I get a mulligan on the international bribery charges?
Folks, Harry's founders know that a great shave comes down to great blades. That seems obvious. Doesn't it? But they are made with sharp, durable steel that lasts, that makes some of the highest quality blades in the world, priced much lower than the leading brand, and they will even give you a full refund if you don't love your shave, as long as you let them know within 30 days. Harry stands behind the quality of their blades. They created a $13 trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave, a weighted ergonomic handle. I mean, to me... Maybe it's not what makes the shave, but it feels better. The experience feels better. It's the ergonomic handle. It's a five-blade razor with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade. We've all, I think I've said many times in the past that because of the asymmetry of my nostrils, the trimmer blade has been a godsend to me, folks. Rich lathering shave gel, a travel blade cover, also very important. How many times you put your hand in your dob kit, comes out, you got like razor cuts. Claim yours by going to harrys.com/majority report. You guys know I love Harry's. I hate to shave. I shave really basically maybe twice a week. Harry's has made it so much more comfortable. I don't know exactly what it is, but the experience is great. And I will also say I just don't like paying a lot of money for a razor. I also don't like leaving my house. So they send it to me. Now our listeners can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/majority report. Make sure you go to harrys.com/majority report. Redeem your offer. Let them know I sent you to help support the show. They have been with us for an extraordinary amount of time all through that. My Klinovich era. Very supportive.
Thurvish.com.
It's coming back. Apparently, Nathan.
Yeesh.
Yes, yeah, Nathan Bernard.
Our buddy Nathan Bernard.
He has got some news to break on like some type of like sex tape.
Laura Loomer and Mike Cernovich.
Oh, my God.
No way.
Oh, gross. My God.
That's what the reports are.
It's so disgusting, man.
That is.
Like in that case, I would say when he goes, who's laughing now? You.
Yes, you got it, buddy.
We're nauseated.
Who's disgusted now, Sam?
Yeah, who's disgusted now, Sam?
How grotesque is this going to get, Sam? All right, look, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Kim Moody. He's got a fascinating book. I feel bad that we're having him on and Jamie's not here today. But she'll love this book. The book is On New Terrain, How Capital is Reshaping the Battleground of Class War. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the founder of Labor Notes, author of several books on U.S. labor, currently a visiting scholar at the Center for the Study of the Production of the Built Environment at the University of Westminster in London, a member of the National Union of Journalists, Kim Moody, on his latest, On New Terrain, How Capital is Reshaping the Battleground of Class War. Kim, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So your book is written in basically three sections. The first speaks to where we are in terms of labor and really attempts to, I guess, question some of the basic assumptions that we have about labor today in this country, myths as to the state of labor. What is the primary myth that you think needs to be addressed?
Well, what I was trying to address in that part, I mean, obviously, if we think of labor as the union movement, it's in very bad shape. I mean, there's just no getting around that. But if we look sort of beneath that, at the changes that people often suggest are the reason for that, namely the changes in the structure of the working class itself, the decline of manufacturing and so forth, and the rise of services are often given as at least one of the reasons why unions haven't been able to organize. Of course, the U.S. government and the employers are probably the main reason for that, but nonetheless. So what I've tried to do is look at, well, how has the working class in the U.S. changed, and what does it mean? And what I'm saying, to summarize it really as briefly as possible, is that, yes, manufacturing jobs have decreased, although actually the output of manufacturing has continued to increase even today under this slow recovery. But the increase in so-called service sector jobs, if you look at this, many of these jobs, I won't say all of them, but many of these jobs are organized in the same way that capital, the employers, have always organized jobs. That is to say that people live from paycheck to paycheck. They work under the command of management. They're dependent on the labor market for their livelihood. And they create the value, even in these services, that is the wealth of society. So if you look at workplaces like warehouses or hospitals or hotels or other kinds of so-called service industries, you're looking at people who are working in conditions that are pretty much comparable to those of a factory in most respects.
I want to circle back to the increased productivity in a moment, but hasn't the assessment of the problems with changing from a sort of, I guess, a manufacturing to a service in terms of labor has been a function of the way that the labor communicates with each other? I mean, so if I'm at a hotel, I'm dispersed throughout the hotel. If I'm a home healthcare worker, I'm obviously much more isolated than I would be if I was working in a factory and we're all in one building and we all go out one door at the change of the shift.
Well, actually, factories were never like that. If you take an automobile factory, which would have been the sort of paradigm of an industrial worker, 20 or 30 years ago, right? Workers don't all work in the same place. They're spread out over huge buildings. People on an assembly line don't work, close together. They can't talk to each other while the thing is going, and so on and so forth. The collectivism that came out of industry, out of factory work or mining or construction or these kind of industries or transportation, doesn't come from the fact that everybody's close together in one building. There are very few manufacturing setups that involve simply one building, at least for the last, 50 or 100 years. And so what I would say is, actually, if you look at a warehouse today, they not only look like factories, but they're organized around, very similar lines of production work, the way workers work. They do, as much as a factory, come into contact. Sometimes they work in teams to unload trucks and reload them and so forth. Or if you think about a hotel, yes, people are working in individual rooms, cleaning them, or working in the restaurant or something like that. But here you actually do have several hundred people working in one building, quite literally, or in a hospital or a hospital complex where you have thousands of workers at all levels, professionals, but also all the, non-medical staff that work in these places are at least as concentrated today as factory workers still are or were 50 years ago. So that's what I'm saying, is that if you look carefully at the way these jobs are done, they're organized along the same lines. Lean production, for example, is common in hospitals today as it is in factories. And it's common in hotels, and it's common in just about any kind of large-scale workplace, whether you're producing paper or services or actual goods or whatever. Because for capital, this is the easiest way. They have to have control over the workforce. That requires everything from the old Taylorism to lean production, and now, going beyond that even, all the methods of surveillance that are used on the workforce in all the places I've mentioned and many more. So I would say that the differences are not as clear as people often think. People are under severe work intensification under the norms of lean production and beyond. There's a lot of pressure on today's workforce.
For the sake of those who are not as familiar with the nomenclature, tell us what you mean by lean production.
Okay, this was introduced in the United States in the 80s. It originates in Japan in the 1950s and 60s, particularly the Toyota Motor Company and so forth introduced it. What it says is that to make a factory or any workplace efficient, you have to eliminate waste. Now, what is waste? Waste could be inventories, for example, or buffers of any kind between phases of production. But it can also be workers. And so in a lean production situation, what some of the labor notes people called management by stress, what you do is, suppose you have 10 workers performing, you know, something along an assembly line or a department. You remove one of them and see if they can produce the same amount. And then you can remove another one and see if they can produce the same amount. Well, obviously people are working harder, although they love to say they're working smarter, but right, they're working harder. and all of this is measured down to a detail that Frederick Taylor never could have dreamed of, because now you have biometrics and all these ways of measuring actual work. And as I said before, the electronic surveillance of various kinds now. So that the ability to standardize work, if you look through management texts and articles these days, when they talk about, they take a survey of, well, how do I improve functioning in my warehouse? The answer is standardize everything. So work is being reduced to its sort of minimum of skill, and in order to speed it up. So that's what lean production is. It means you take out the fat in the labor process, and you do this by mathematical measurements and electronic measurement and so forth. It's much more scientific than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Right. This was, I think, examined in that mid-80s in that movie that Michael Keaton, the comedy Gung Ho, if I remember correctly. But I'm drawing on a wide range of
that was
of
sort
reference.
Of a crude,
it was a crude version of it. But that's I would love to go back. Actually, that's what I remembered as I was reading about the lean economy. I remember Gung Ho for whatever reason. I'd like to go back to see how prophetic that may have been. Leaving Gung Ho aside for a moment, so we have all of these supposed myths that we have bought into on some level. I mean, certainly, I feel like over the past 10 or 15 years, as we discussed the decline in unionism, and obviously, like you say, there's other structural factors, but people have said that the nature of our workforce has declined. But the long and short of it is, has changed. And the long and short of it is, it has not changed that dramatically from other times where we have seen labor exercise power. And then the second, section of your book talks about how capital has restructured itself in a way that is less maybe durable than we've also been led to believe. Is that a fair way of characterizing it?
Yeah, what I tried to do, is there are a lot of books now, really good stuff on the nature of capitalism and capitalist crisis and sort of big trends measured, you know, in numbers and everything. What I tried to do is say, well, how is capital organizing itself? Not only in the United States, but on a world scale, of course, but definitely in the United States. And there are two things I looked at here. One is the enormous merger movement that began in the 90s and continues even now, although it's not at the same speed. But the importance of that is that what businesses were doing, and this hit literally every sector, not just manufacturing, but services, just about every service industry you can look at, and transportation and pretty much everything. What they've done is they've undone what was done in the 1960s. That is, they've gotten away from conglomeration. In the 60s, mergers were to create conglomerates, corporations that did lots of different things. And what capital has discovered in the sort of fire of international competition is that it actually makes them more sense for them, particularly if they're going to apply things like what I was talking about before, lean production or whatever, to focus on, you know, the things they do best. Sometimes they call this core competence or whatever you want to call it, but producing more or less the same type of product throughout the same corporation. So these companies are bigger, but they're more focused. And what this means is they're actually more like the corporations that union organized in the 1930s. They've kind of gone back to that. That is to say, USX dumped its oil subsidiary and became U.S. Steel again. The auto companies, two of them, dumped their financial units to concentrate, and as did GE, to concentrate on manufacturing and so on. So if you can get into these companies to organize them, you instead of having to organize lots of tiny factories, you can organize a company the way it was done more or less in the 1930s. And then the second thing I looked at was how do they move things around? How are the nation's goods, whether they're imports or produced here, being moved around? Because when you look at not only the production of, say, final goods, like an automobile or something, but the production of services, all of these things depend on supply chains. And this is the other big reorganization of the last 20 to 30 years, and some of it is very new. That is to say, they've streamlined the along, again, lean production notion. Just-in-time delivery is particularly important in this.
I want to go slow here for this, because I found this logistics stuff to be really fascinating. Talk about that just-in-time. I don't know if people are familiar with what that means.
Right. Okay. This was introduced within factories, particularly in the automobile industry in the 80s. As I said, it's taken from Japan, from the Toyota system in particular. And what it says is in the old way manufacturing was done in just about any industry is that every product that is produced in turn uses inputs, other parts and components that come to them via a supply chain. The old way of doing that was the final assembler, let's say General Electric or General Motors, would stock these parts. It would have huge amounts of inventory. But the problem is inventory is expensive, and lean production tells you shouldn't be keeping these expensive inventories. You should be moving things as you need them. In other words, just in time. So these components come to the assembly line as needed, rather than sitting around in a warehouse somewhere. And so that radically changed the way supply chains were structured, because the just-in-time thing goes all the way down the supply chain. Each step in the production of a final product is to be delivered just in time, for production. That means everything is tighter, much tighter.
And also the final product is there's a lot less. I mean, there has been a lot more sort of like, I guess, smart inventorizing of the final product, right? We're not going to pay to store our final product in the same way that we may have like 30, 40 years ago.
That's right. That's right. And so the inventories have been not eliminated, but reduced greatly, which, by the way, I'll get to this in a second, but it also changed the nature of warehousing and transportation. So with just-in-time, it also means that these supply chains are much more vulnerable, because if you have, let's say, a delay in delivery of a part to a key plant, that key plant can't produce the car or the table or the refrigerator or whatever it is without the part. And so this has become, on the one hand, the way to compete is to move things faster like that throughout the whole supply chain. On the other hand, though, it means every time there's a hurricane or a tsunami, or for that matter, a strike, it can affect the whole supply chain and close down plants that aren't even directly affected by the weather or whatever it is. Actually, the most common disruption in supply chains these days is IT failure, which I thought was interesting because they totally depend on, IT to keep track of the things that are moving along the supply chain. But anyway, so it seems
and also just
more
say
vulnerable.
Too, in terms of that logistics, too, I mean, I think this is a little bit afield, but this is applicable to a lot of other issues that I think we're having in this country, you know, I mean, just in terms of like even in food and stuff like this. I mean, that phenomena of just-in-time and sort of like lean production has really left a lot of supply lines very vulnerable, and I find that fascinating. But let's talk about the way that you talk about logistics clusters and the implications
right.
of that. Yet let's talk about that in transportation and how there's another level of vulnerability there. And we should say, and just to remind people, this is about the dynamic between the labor and capital, and where might labor have power that it didn't have in the past?
Exactly. Yeah, the clusters. This is everybody will remember, who has looked at manufacturing, that beginning 40 or so years ago, all these companies, manufacturing companies, began outsourcing things, right? So you moved production to somewhere in the middle of nowhere. You moved it out of Detroit or out of Gary or out of Pittsburgh or wherever, or out of Los Angeles in the case of General Motors and so on, and into supply, outsourced suppliers that were located sometimes even in semi-rural areas, often out on the interstate, so to speak. Well, as you move things farther away, then transportation and warehousing and these aspects of logistics become more and more important, because you have to move things all over the country or even from abroad. You have to move them to the final assembly point. And since the transportation grids in the United States have actually been formed for, the last, well, in the case of railroads, 100 or more years, in the case of the interstate highways, the last 70 or so years, these things are already in existence. And you have certain places, whether it's ports like Los Angeles or New York, New Jersey, or the big central transport hub, Chicago, in the middle of the country, and there are others. There are about 60 of these clusters. And what they do is things come in, parts come in, whether they're domestically produced or imports. Then they're reorganized in a warehouse and they go out somewhere else, either to a retailer or to a final assembly manufacturer or some other manufacturer. So in order to do that, though, what capital has done, and this is the irony of it, they moved all their, as much production as they could, out of the old concentrations of blue-collar workers in these old industrial towns, particularly in the Midwest, but also on the West Coast and the East Coast. But now, to move things around, they've recreated these huge clusters that employ tens of thousands and sometimes more blue-collar workers who are moving things around, and even in some cases producing things in warehouses, sort of the final touch before they go to Walmart stores or whatever. And so, for example, you know, the official figures of, say, the Chicago cluster. When I say cluster, I'm talking about, you know, scores and scores, perhaps 300 warehouses, all in a finite area, intermodal rail and truck yards. These are gigantic things. I just toured some around Chicago in April, and these things are phenomenal to look at. And so these tens of thousands of workers in the Chicago one, the official figure is about 160,000 people work in logistics. And that figure doesn't actually include everybody. It doesn't include railroad workers, postal workers, IT workers, utility workers, all of whom are necessary to the clusters. And the same thing in, you know, L.A., Long Beach, and the Inland Empire off of that, and now increasingly around the Bay Area, and more of them in one in Texas. Two other big ones are Memphis, which is where FedEx has its center, and Louisville for UPS. All these things have these tens of thousands of blue-collar workers in a finite geographic area. So what capital has done inadvertently, to be sure, has created these huge concentrations of labor, of very basic labor, and this time much of it very poorly paid, particularly warehouse workers and related workers. Some, like truckers and railroad workers and so forth, are unionized, but many, perhaps most, are not. And this is the thing. Here you have a situation, people working in these warehouses that I have argued are basically like factories. They're huge and they employ hundreds and sometimes as many as 1,000 people in one warehouse. all of them together in sort of the same area, many of them living in the suburban areas. That used to be, we would think of the suburbs as white and middle class. This is no longer the case, not of all of them anyway. More and more, you'll have at least a third of the population will be black or Latino. And the workforce in a lot of these clusters, by the way, is in the majority African American and Latino, with maybe a quarter to a third women. And these are groups that historically tend to be more favorable to unionism. So what I'm saying is that, you know, if the unions want to grow, here's a place to focus. Here's a place to concentrate. You know, places, because they're all over the country. Yet the unions are not doing that.
Now, So is the idea that these areas are ripe for unionization, and then ultimately, you know, the power that comes with that collectivism, or is it that the power that comes with the dynamic that is a choke point, if you will, or a vulnerability that capital has that would be highly vulnerable to any type of withholding of labor? I mean, based upon what we've seen with teachers in the half a dozen or so states that we've seen over the past, I don't know, couple of months, in states where there's no real, you know, the unions are not terribly vibrant or even legal in these places. Is it,
right.
Are we dealing with a situation here where, A, the unions are not recognizing it? And if so, I want to just ask you why. Because, I mean, they're supposed to, right? I mean, that's their job as union officials would be to sort of say, like, oh, here are potential sources of power. We can empower these people, and they can, you know, we can empower a union here. I can understand why the workers themselves, I mean, certainly capital hasn't necessarily recognized that they've created this vulnerability or not enough for them to stop. And part of that is because there's been a lack of recognition by labor there, both organized and unorganized, that there's a significant amount of power. Why are unions not responding to what you see?
Yeah, well, let's go back one step to what you said about choke points. That's the really important thing. Not only are there huge concentrations of workers doing more or less the same kind of labor, but, you know, these are the choke points in the whole system of production, not only of goods, but of services, in the country and around the world, for that matter. So there is a potential power there. But, of course, in order to use that power, you have to be organized to some degree, whether it's, you know, the way the teachers have done it, you know, an absolutely amazing thing, and you're totally right. The unions, such as they even existed, played, you know, at best a secondary role and sometimes even got in the way. So that's a possibility. I'm not denying that. One reason why the unions don't go into these places is that there are difficulties with it. For example, warehouse labor is mostly, in its majority, contingent, precarious. That is, a lot of these are temporary workers, you know. And while I don't believe for a minute that it's impossible to organize those workers, it does have legal difficulties and so forth. The second reason, I think, is that it's not that union leaders or the research departments or whatever don't know these things that I'm talking about. It's that they're kind of afraid. Well, what do you do if you actually close down, let's say, not only a warehouse, but a whole cluster of these warehouses, and the economy comes to a grinding halt, at least, let's say, in the Midwest or the West Coast or something like that? Well, the government's going to step in, isn't it? And so you're taking a risk. And unfortunately, one of the great characteristics of our business union labor leadership is caution, particularly when it comes to legal problems. We on the left, who look at the potential workers' power, feel that, like the teachers recently in these right-to-work states, kind of did everything that was illegal and got away with it, not only got away with it, but actually won things. Well, okay, you could do that here in these clusters, I believe. But union leaders are cautious. They think about, what do I get out of this?
But isn't there a difference? I mean, this is the thing, is that, you know, there seems to me that there's a fundamental difference that puts teachers in a better position than, say, someone who works at an Amazon warehouse, in that they have a relationship with the community, the teachers do, because they have this relationship with the parents. It's an intense relationship where the parents are actually reaching out to the teachers, right? The teachers don't have to do outreach in the same way. The parents are right there. And in many instances, you can't escape them, I think, from a teacher's perspective. I don't know. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But where the workers in these warehouses do not have the same relationship to any other constituency in the community, right? I mean, because I may not even see the person I deliver the stuff to, or... I mean, or do they?
Well, here's the thing. No, I mean, yes and no. Obviously, teachers, nurses are another group that strike a lot these days, right? And the reason they can get away with it, is that, like teachers, these are people who are respected, even if they don't have direct contact with the community other than through patients and families like that, their work is respected. You know, warehouse workers, factory workers, truck drivers, etc. Unfortunately, the culture is such that, you know, they're not respected in the same way, and so they have to derive their support in the community in different ways. And, you know, what I would say is that on the one hand, you know, there was a time when labor understood that, and sometimes this has even happened. Remember the 1997 UPS strike? This became a cause célèbre nationally. People were supporting it. The public supported it. And the reason was, they said, well, look, you know, America cannot work part-time. We need good full-time jobs, you know. So they put out a message, which was the major goal of the strike, or at least one of them, a message that reverberated with all kinds of working people, you know. And so we have to find a way, you know, to do that in terms of, you know, we're the people who move the goods and create the wealth of this country. But we're not being respected, we're not being paid well, the work is undependable, dead-end kind of work, and you know, is we can't make a living at it. You know, a more of a social kind of thing. But secondly, one thing I discovered in this tour I took of the warehouse district outside of Chicago is that, in fact, some of these towns, particularly in that case, Joliet, Illinois, this is a place, who thinks about Joliet, Illinois? Right. Well, it turns out the organizers who are doing some work in these warehouses said, well, you know, when we want to meet warehouses, we go door to door in Joliet because every other person living here has worked in one of these warehouses. So, yes, they can get some community support there. And also because a lot of people who come from Chicago are African American and Latinos. They have kind of communities, you know, that they can get from support from, immigrant communities and cultural communities that they can get support from. But the thing is that somebody has to have a strategy that points to all of this, and you know, it isn't really there. It's not that nobody thinks about these things. It just it hasn't gelled yet. I want to say, though, that there are efforts to organize in these clusters. We shouldn't think that nothing is happening. Most of these are done in the few places I know about, not in a traditional union way, even though they're often backed by a union. For example, in the Chicago area, the United Electrical Workers gave some support for the launching of something called Warehouse Workers for Justice. And it's a what we call a workers center. It's a community-based organization in this county around this huge cluster and in Chicago as well. That has done a number of fantastic things among warehouse workers there. I'll just give you one quick example. Walmart used to force the workers who unloaded and loaded trucks in their warehouse to get paid by the truckload. Well, you know, that's a very precarious thing because truckloads are different and, you know, it forces you to work hard rather than being paid by the hour. Well, the Warehouse Workers for Justice took this up, discovered it was actually illegal to do this, and won the case so that they suppressed that thing. So you can do things through collective action. They've even had some strikes there, not recently, but a few years ago. You know, there are things happening. We shouldn't say that nothing is happening.
I want to move to your concept of a militant minority, and why that's needed to be recreated, and we'll talk a little bit about electoral politics as well. But let's start with that militant minority.
Right. Well, okay. One thing we know about the working class, you know, is that it isn't a homogeneous clump, you know, that like any social reality, it has layers. It not only has different races and genders and ethnicities and so forth, but it also has layers of people who are more active than others, some who are more apathetic. and so forth. The concept of the militant minority actually goes back just about 100 years ago to the syndicalists, or people like the IWW and so forth, who said, look, you know, in any working class setting, you've got people, maybe a small number to begin with, who are the most conscious workers. They kind of think about this stuff a lot. They talk to their fellow workers. They perhaps are socialists of some sort, or wobblies, or even anarchists, or whatever. You know, and so they said this layer, this activist layer, is a minority, but it's the more militant section of the class. Now, that existed in this country up through the 1940s. To a large extent, it was destroyed by McCarthyism and you know, even by prosperity for some people and so forth, repressed by the union bureaucracy itself often. So we haven't really had, you always have an activist layer, but the question is this activist layer thinking in big terms? Are they looking at the big picture? You know, are the activists in this warehouse thinking about themselves as a choke point in the economy, or are they just thinking of themselves as messed over workers, you know? So the militant minority is something that is kind of political, you know, in the broadest sense of the word. And I don't mean by that they have to belong to some group or something like that, but I do mean by that they think in bigger terms. Now, I would say my observation, having, you know, been with Labor Notes for many years and continued to watch developments, is that slowly but surely something like this is taking shape in the U.S. once again. And one of the major reasons for this, actually, promoters of this, has been the Project Labor Notes. You may know that at their last conference in April, there were 3,000 activists there. You know, union activists and community activists, working class community activists, immigrant workers, just every kind of worker you could think of, and certainly the teachers as well. You know, they were all there together in the same conference, exchanging ideas, going to workshops, and you know, becoming more aware of the big picture. So I would say that this is something, you know, we on the left can't just go out and create this. It's an organic process, but it also requires, you know, help, organization, education. And the thing that Labor Notes has been doing for the last umpteen years, particularly in the last couple of dozen years, you know, is having these week, one-day schools, these conferences every other year, and educating people to publications. Long before any of the unions or anybody else, Labor Notes was putting out the handbooks on how to deal with lean production and all of that back in the 80s and 90s. And still, you know, the Troublemakers Handbook and the brand new thing on, you know, how to be a successful organizer. These kind of things, these books sell in the thousands. And people are, activists are reading these books, along with, of course, other stuff, not just these. So, yes, I think there's a process that this kind of militant minority, it won't look exactly like the old one, but I think it's taking shape. And when it becomes increasingly conscious of itself, it's going to be more able to do things like intervene in these unorganized parts of the whole logistics thing, or unorganized industries, or partially organized industries.
And so, I just want to be clear too on just on the concept, which is that you don't need 100% or 80% or even, you know, 50% of the workforce to become conscious of its role in this context. You need a small minority who is willing to essentially provide leadership, organic leadership that comes from within the working class. I mean, I I happen to think that's a similar dynamic to just politics in generally. You know,
yes.
Having been someone in the business of preaching to the choir for 15, 20 years, I'm quite convinced that the choir is really, you just need a choir that's motivated enough and, right. And aware of what's going on. And they're the ones who do all the bake sales, essentially. I don't want to carry that too far, but that's being the point. And so, all right, lastly, let me just get your take on electoral politics, because you are not convinced that there is a – give me – I guess why don't you express just your perspective on the usefulness of electoral politics as it stands, and where you think from a this perspective, you know, some of that militant minority should pursue, I guess.
Right. Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is that any kind of electoral politics that, you know, the working class activists or left activists are going to be involved in my opinion, has to be based on existing social base, you know, of reality. It's no good just to go out and put some candidates up. They're not going to win, you know, and even if they do, without a real social base, you know, they're not going to be able to have the impact that you would want. So from my point of view, building this social base, whether it's in the workplace, which I think is the primary place where power is, or whether it's in the community, you know, around issues like housing as well as, you know, workplace issues and education and so forth, you've got to have a mass base that is, you know, mobilizable and that, you know, is kind of on the program, not just in order to have a, you know, an electoral majority, but to have a force that can act in the streets, you know, take direct action. Electoral politics without that kind of backing is not going to work, you know, and I have a little critique in there, which I think unfortunately has sort of come true about some of these new formations in Europe, like, say, Podemos and so forth, that as they got away from their initial social base into electoralism, they actually did worse. You know, so you have this difficult dilemma with electoral politics. The second thing to say is electoral politics can really be a distraction historically, but also it can be, you know, a direction, because we do need to do something about the bigger political issues that you can't necessarily do just in the workplace or through the union. So that's important. The other thing
I feel
I'm
like,
saying,
you know,
though,
let me just insert here before you, yeah. like that. I mean, I would love a long form investigation of what happened in Madison, Wisconsin, where we saw that sort of like that labor uprising that got very quickly funneled into electoral politics and really sort of, I think, with fairly, I don't want to say disastrous, but disastrous results. I mean, I guess is really, but continue. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, you're right. And this is the thing, because there isn't, you know, we do have to be somewhat realistic. There isn't a major electoral alternative for the left or for, you know, the kind of working class movement that we're talking about here at the moment. Unfortunately, there are a significant number, even a large number of people on the left who think that you can do this through the Democratic Party. And, you know, Wisconsin is one example of maybe why that isn't a very good idea. But on a bigger level, you know, what I would say is that, first of all, this has been tried many times before, and it never goes anywhere. The Democratic Party has been moving to the right since the mid-1970s at least, and hasn't stopped moving to the right.
Do you not think that the Democratic Party is now moving to the left? I mean, that at least in the past, my sense is in the last 5 to 10 years, I mean, we've seen and the, I mean, I haven't seen the action yet. Granted, we're really just talking about lip service at this point. But the lip service, you know, first the lips and then maybe the body follows when you're talking about things like a job guarantee. I mean, I think to a certain extent, labor was hoodwinked largely when it came to like things like card check. But certainly we have a Democratic Party that is moving. If it is moving in a direction, it is moving to the left. I think the proof is yet to be shown in the pudding, but it is moving to the left. I mean, that to me seems, I mean, Cory Booker's calling for, you know, a job guarantee pilot program. You're going to have Kristen Gillibrand putting one out. You're going to have Bernie Sanders not nominally a Democrat.
To me, this is always the problem. You know, you can say, well, you know, it's Bernie Sanders, it's that guy, it's Elizabeth Warren, blah, 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 and that's it. You know, where's the rest of it? I mean, they're moving to the left of the far neoliberal direction they went. You might say what they're moving towards is back towards the center, some of them. But by and large, I mean, you know, I look at this stuff. Maybe we see different things, I guess, but I don't see it. And I think the problem is that this party and the politicians, with rare exceptions, and you have to remember, Bernie actually isn't a Democrat. I mean, I know for all practical purposes he works with them, but he doesn't depend on his elections on them, even now. Right. But never mind that rare exception. You know, not only do all the candidates, including Elizabeth Warren, take corporate money, but the party structures from top to bottom are awash in this stuff. It's just astronomical, the amount of corporate money they depend on. So, yes, they can talk about jobs programs, and, you know, there's even some movement on single payer and so forth. And it is true that if there is a social upheaval, they will move to the left relative to where they are now. But that's actually part of the problem. I know this sounds counterintuitive, but historically they moved to the left in order to incorporate the social movements. That's right. What they did with the labor movement in the 30s and 40s. It's what they did with the civil rights and women's movement and so forth in the 60s and 70s. You know, the whole history of it is that, yes, we used to say back in the day that we called the Democratic Party the graveyard of social movements. You get a movement that pushes politics in the U.S. to the left, not only the Democrats, by the way, but the kind of discourse of politics moves to the left when there are large social movements. And so the Democrats will move to the left somewhat and you know, so forth, in order to get elected and all the rest of it. But if you look at what they've done in the last 50 years, it isn't there. You know, all the promises about things, you know, from, you know, Clinton onward at least, and actually before that, you know, they've abandoned the cities. Clinton killed all the urban programs. And all the rest of it. There's no jobs programs. There's no planning.
I think there's no doubt that, I mean, really since the late 60s, the Democrats have not delivered on the promise in many respects. No doubt. And I guess the question is going forward. I mean, and we've discussed that ad nauseum, here, and their neoliberal turns. The question is going forward, and I also agree. Aside from an assessment of the Democratic Party as a vehicle, that it's very possible to take a social movement and let the air out of the tires, as it were, by channeling that energy too quickly into electoral politics. As a vehicle going forward, if there is some value to electoral politics, what is the vision of what those electoral politics will look like? If it either including or not including the Democratic Party.
Well, I mean, programmatically, I think, you know, everybody on the left can, at this point, can pretty much say what those things need to be. You know, we can start with single-payer health care would be so obvious, you know, a thing. Yes, jobs programs of some sort, some kind of labor law reform that actually does something. I mean, you know, a radical labor reform. Begin talking about, you know, the nationalization or municipalization of certain kinds of industries and services that you know need to be taken under control. And if you see, my idea is, I think if we're going to have an electoral thing down the road that's going to get anywhere, it has to start at the local level. Running presidents and senators and things like this, you know, it's not going to work in the beginning. You've got to build this thing from the grassroots up, and that requires workplace power and directing that way. It requires community power, organizations, social movements, all the rest of it, beginning to challenge, you know, these Democrats. I mean, I was looking at the programs, some of this is in my book, of these things like the Progressive Caucus in the New York City Council. I mean, never mind the one in Congress, it's so pathetic. Right. But even the one in New York City, I mean, it just completely collapsed. It's just a function of whatever Mayor de Blasio wants at this point. You know, and he's done some good things, but he also does the standard things. He gives actually more tax abatements to business than Bloomberg or Giuliani did. You know, so it's the same kind of thing, giving away the tax base that you could use to create jobs, to create real health care and these kind of things. All these kind of issues, you know, plus the police. I mean, we cannot get around the question of the militarization of law enforcement in the U.S. That has to be dealt with. And the Democrats are not dealing with. They did this program. It was Clinton who did the program of giving
community
free
policing,
military
right.
hardware to the police.
Yep.
You know, it wasn't the Republicans. And, you know, they're not very clear on this stuff. Some of them have said better things than others, but, you know, it's still out there. So all of these kind of issues are issues on which I believe the Democrats at the local level, particularly in the big cities, and this goes back to just what I was talking about before, all these new concentrations of workers in these metropolitan areas, mobilizing that once it gets going, to challenge the Democrats. Look at what Chicago, again, you know, with the Rahm Emanuel and all that, the
yep.
teachers union had to fight the Democrats. and that isn't over by any means. And, you know, so what I'm saying is it's a long-term view. I don't think just getting up and everybody running for office, you know, in the near future is gonna work, because we're not prepared for it. You know, it's amateur hour, and there isn't a social base. And I know there's a lot of emphasis on this coming even from Bernie and so forth. But I think, you know, this is to put it sort of crudely, the charge of the Light Brigade. And
not quite ripe. Well,
what?
Not quite ripe yeah. enough. Well, it's a fascinating book on New Terrain, How Capital is Reshaping the Battleground ground of Class War. Kim Moody, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
All right, folks, we've got to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will take your phone calls, we will play some sound clips, and a reminder, this show relies on you for its very existence. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you become a member, we say thank you by giving you extra content every day. And, of course, you have the archives, which you have access to as a member. And we're gonna work on putting the deep archives up, too, I think. We just got to figure out a way of organizing it. And cataloging. But for the meantime, you have archives for all the member shows from the history of time, from the dawn of history, I should say. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. Today is Tuesday. That's the Michael Brooks Show day. And today on the show is...
Saad Haider on Mistaken Identity and Alona Minkowski's in studio.
Oh, she is? Oh, good.
Yes.
And don't forget, of course, you can check out Jamie's podcast, The Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada. And Matt's new podcast. That like it sounded like a fart noise in the beginning.
A digital fart.
Water boot.
It's called Literary Hangover. Did you drop a new one, or did you get?
No, it's released on the first and third Saturdays of the month. But I'm going to release an episode we recorded during the Democratic primary on 1984 later this week.
Wait a second, what?
This has been an idea I've had for a while, and me and my friend recorded a sort of pilot a couple of years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, on 1984 by George Orwell. So I'm going to put that on.
And you did this during the Democratic primary?
This was during the primary, yeah. So like Bernie, it's like we're talking about like Bernie. Remember that time where Hillary's like, I don't see where Bernie was when I was doing this healthcare thing. And then before the end of the debate, there was a video of Bernie literally on stage promoting the healthcare initiative.
Literally there. It's like we 1984. Freaking moron.
It was a much more hopeful time when we recorded that one.
Yeah, I can hear. that was like, let's use 1984 to show why Hillary's stupid. Things are really changing around
That's
here.
That's right.
7 months later.
Oh, God. All right, folks, quick break, and we'll head to the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. Join us if you are a member.
C'est une poupée qui fait non, 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 non. Personne ne lui a jamais appris.